And we're going to start in the reverse order of what is on the agenda. So the first bill to be heard will be Senate Bill 436. Marjorie, would you like to...
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, Senate Bill 436 exempts physicians from discipline for treating pain with controlled substances for the duration of intractable pain, and it eliminates requirement for evaluation by physician specialist prior to the treatment.
Okay. Kathleen Haley and Dr. Okay. And Dr. Williams? Yes. You want Jonah?
Uh-huh.
Okay. And Senator Dukes, would you mind coming up, please? Okay. I know they are. Welcome.
Let me get your testimony here.
Okay. I thought we were going to start off with this one here. They're both in here. I understand that. We can check them come on. She can read that.
Okay. Good afternoon. Senator Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Kathleen Haley, and I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners. And we come today to voice opposition to portions of Senate Bill 436. First, let me tell you that the board has a long history of supporting the medical goal of controlling a patient's pain for as long as it lasts. And to illustrate that, I have sent out for you now to take a look at the intractable pain packet that the board sends to physicians who have questions about how to prescribe narcotics for people who have chronic pain. I've also included in with this testimony, I also want you to take a look at the board's statement of philosophy on pain management. And in that statement of philosophy, it says that the board urges the use of effective pain control for all patients, irrespective of the etiology of their pain. And this includes, but is not limited to, postoperative pain, chronic pain of diverse etiology, and pain derived from malignancies. Given that the board does have this long-standing policy of seeing that physicians will prescribe adequately for pain, the board does have concerns about the requirement being removed that a physician first have the source of that pain confirmed by a specialist. And to put it in the most simplistic terms, if someone went to a physician with a headache, the board would like that patient to be seen by a specialist to ensure that there isn't something bigger wrong, like a brain tumor or something else, before simply saying that prescribing narcotics alone would be sufficient to address that problem. Now, this Federation of State Medical Boards is all the medical boards around the country. And coming up in April, the board is co-sponsoring with another medical board that the resolution adopted by the Federation actually addressed the issue of underprescribing for pain management. In Oregon, we were the first state to discipline a physician for underprescribing for pain medicine. The difficulty for board members and physicians is to find that balance and to address those patients that have pain, make sure it's addressed, but also to ensure that there isn't the selling of these medications on the street, which quite frankly happens. Now, I've been the director of the board for 8 years, and in the last few months, for the first time, we are really seeing patients dying from improper prescribed medications. And that's a turn of events the board does not want to see. And for that reason, I urge you to continue to have the requirement that physicians have a specialist take a look at patients before simply prescribing controlled substances. I'm happy to answer any questions, and I appreciate the opportunity to address you this afternoon.
Ms. Haley, back in, I believe it was 1997, we made some changes specific to the statute I think in part because we were dealing with physician-assisted suicide, which we referred back to the people, and they soundly reaffirmed their choice in that matter. But we also had a broad range of discussions relevant to this practice area. And can you, or I don't recall if you were there at the time, I'm trying to remember what it was that we put in the statute or how we dealt with the issue, because we did want to encourage physicians to utilize pain medications at that time.
Chair Morissette, Senator Minnis, my understanding is that we did add in this issue of having the specialist take a look at the patient, but we also said that if there is a question, because maybe somebody can't get to a specialist, maybe they're in a rural area and they can't get there, or maybe they can't afford it, maybe they don't have health insurance and they can't afford to go to see the specialist, then under those circumstances there would be a waiver of that requirement. And we do have a physician on staff, a medical director that can do that.
Okay. Other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think in conjunction with that also, there was a problem with the fact that it had to have somebody else up the ladder look at it. It was an absolute mandatory thing, and we had people going originally to the person that was at the top of the ladder to have the diagnosis made, and then they had to send them somewhere else. Where do you send them? I mean, after you get to the top person in the at the chain of the specialty, to have to send them back down the ladder doesn't make any sense, and it's pretty impossible for people that maybe go to the Mayo Clinic or some other place a long ways away. And so we made some adjustments to that, and I can't remember, I believe it was 1999, it was either 97 or 99,
yeah.
And it possibly was in conjunction with our pain management task force, I'm not just totally certain, but I think it has been pretty adequately taken care of.
Okay. Thank you. Dr. Williams?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Vern Williams. I'm the medical director for the NAR Indian Health Clinic, which is the Native American Rehabilitation Association in Portland. I'm board certified in internal medicine and have a special interest in addiction medicine. I've been a primary care doctor in Portland and Oregon for the last 19 years. I serve in what we call the trenches. I'm a doc that sees the patients when they walk in the door, and I'm seeing them 5 years later, oftentimes for those same problems. And I do think that that combination of my experiences do offer some validity to my opinions on this law, which I support staying the way it has been written at present. I don't support the changes. The reason I don't support the changes is primarily focused about good patient care. The fundamental aspect of good patient care is an accurate diagnosis from the get-go. The need for accurate diagnosis is proportional to the particular problem that's presented, but more so the treatment plan that's going to be involved. In other words, the higher risk the treatment, the more important it is that the diagnosis be known accurately. Again, I would go back to Ms. Haley's example of a headache, or perhaps even better would be, in my opinion, chest pain. A patient can come in with chest pain and ultimately be referred for a bypass surgery, and I would anticipate that the physician as well as the patient want to be certain that in fact they have a blocked coronary artery and not a bruised rib before they go in for surgery. And I view the therapies that we're talking about as serious as bypass surgery. You're looking at, in bypass surgery, there's an up to 5% morbidity risk, perhaps close to 1% mortality risk. Chronic narcotic usage is in the same, has the same type of risk in terms of addiction. Addiction kills people. When it doesn't kill people, it destroys families. It harms kids. It tears up our communities. It costs us a lot of money. It costs a lot. It causes a lot of suffering that I see all the time. The way the law stands, it keeps a high bar for quality of care. It's asking that we know what we're doing when we're treating somebody. It's asking that in order for us to assess the benefits and the risk of our treatment, we know what it is we're treating. And that may be a higher bar than some other states. I don't know, but it's an appropriate bar. you would be hard-pressed, I think, to find many clinics that have a higher percentage of uninsured patients than our clinic. We run about 50% of our patients have no insurance. Our clinic does not cover specialty referral care. We have had to work hard at times to get this second opinion requirement met, but we've done it. Good quality care sometimes takes a little extra work. That sometimes means making extra phone calls, making arrangements to get people in to be seen. Of the people we've sent for that second opinion, I would estimate, and I did not investigate this, I didn't have time, but 20%, I would say, of our patients that we've sent for that second opinion have, with the anticipation that they were going to require long-term narcotic usage, came back with diagnosis for which long-term narcotics were not indicated and not appropriate. Or they came back with a diagnosis or with information that helped us to determine that they, in fact, had an addiction problem that needed to be treated. It's a good tool. It's a tool for the patients. It's a tool for the community. It's a tool for the primary care doctor. The docs I talked to about this rule, this law, support it. They think it's a good thing because it helps us put a framework together to address this problem. This problem is a nightmare for primary care doctors. We're terrified of addicting people. We're terrified of causing problems like this. We're also terrified of not taking care of pain when it's appropriate to do so with narcotics. It's a very tough role we're in right now. We need help. We need help like this that helps put things into a framework. So that's my opinion. Thank you. Do you have any questions?
Senator Minas.
Doctor, the current law says that the physician shall obtain an evaluation by one or more physicians specializing in a particular body area that's believed to be the source of intractable pain. How is that accomplished now? How would you do that if you had a patient?
Chairman Morissette and Senator Minas. In that scenario, we will refer. It depends on the problem. Most of the problems we see are musculoskeletal in nature. Mm-hmm. So we generally will use neurosurgeons, physiatrists, and orthopedic doctors.
Okay. How about what's an arthritis doctor? I can't remember the name.
Rheumatologist. Yes. Yeah, we use rheumatologist also. I am fortunate. I'm in Portland. We've got a lot of specialists, so we spread it around so we don't overburden people.
But is this accomplished by actually referring the patient from the primary care physician's office for another physical evaluation with the specialist?
Right.
Or is it a phone consultation?
No. I send these folks. We do as much as we can in our office. We provide all the information that we've obtained for that patient to that specialist and then help arrange for that appointment.
Okay. And, doctor, how would you deal with a situation where, in your opinion, as a physician, the person is in intractable pain and there's a need to prescribe something to deal with the pain? How do you deal with that? It seems like there would be a period of time within which you'd have to get the person into the specialist's office. And
absolutely. And there's usually quite a period of time before they come in to see me. And I don't mean to sound insensitive, but these are chronic pain patients. We're not talking in, I assume, and I have been talking here, not about terminally ill cancer patients. I'm not talking about acute pain. I'm talking about chronic pain. These patients have had pain for a long period of time. And if it takes a few more weeks to get in, to get seen, to get the opinion, I think that's good care. I would not send somebody for chemotherapy.
You don't think that's insensitive? Because you're talking to somebody with intractable pain.
I would not ignore the pain. I would not ignore other modalities.
I would just suggest that somebody that has the form of arthritis that I have and the pain that I go through, if you were a primary care physician, you told me to wait 2 weeks to go see a rheumatologist before you prescribe something for it, I would suggest that that's probably malpractice.
Senator Minas, if a patient came to me with an acute episode of arthritis, as an arthritis generally will present if it's a rheumatoid type of arthritis, that's an acute pain scenario, in which case the patient would then be referred on to a rheumatologist with an eye towards the chronic care component.
You know, Mr. Chairman, I understand what you're trying to do to prevent drug abusers from, you know, forcing or intimidating a primary care physician into writing a prescription for Vicodin or Oxycontin or some other kind of medication that might be appealing to them. But it just seems to me that if you're a physician, if in your medical opinion the person should have the prescription, and you don't believe, and there's no basis to believe that they're an abuser, that you should have the privilege of at least writing a temporary prescription until the specialist has been seen. Why wouldn't you write enough script to get them through 2 weeks? until they get to the specialist.
You're asking me, Senator, to respond to a specific scenario or a general scenario, and I'm not clear. You're right, in certain situations, in certain specific scenarios, for example, we'll have patients that are traveling through town and for very valid reasons have need a refill on their prescriptions. We're able to obtain documentation from their previous physicians on the workups that have been done, and in fact we'll prescribe medications for them in that kind of a situation. So specific situations, you know, are unique. That's the nature of them.
Thank you. My someone I know very well is diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis, but the tests don't show that she has rheumatoid arthritis, and there is chronic pain. And so far, that's a mystery. It's unsolved. And so I think that treating chronic pain is important. I think it's more important to find the cause of it, but if you can't find the cause through a series of tests, it's very frustrating. But anyway, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're probably wondering why I didn't start with Senator John Dukes. I wanted to hear some of the other arguments. And I want you to hear some of the arguments. And so would you please come up? And Representative Hansen, would you please come up? Williams. Yeah, Vern Williams.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Joan Duke, State Senator from District 16. And I don't think there's any of you that I haven't seen over the last 10 years in a committee working on pain management. Last session
we feel it, too.
You feel it. Thank you. last session, we all created the Oregon Commission on Pain Management. And Representative Hansen and I have been appointed as ex officio members to that commission, and working with them, they've identified some areas, and we have these three bills at their request. I'll give you a little bit, but the experts are really behind me. Senate Bill 436 is something that was flagged for me a number of years ago. Senator Fisher may remember because he served on that pain management task force, and they produced a report, and it's included in that report. The problem of this being the only medical condition, intractable pain, for which we require a second opinion. And the delay in medical treatment that results in. And the other thing is, it would be one thing if we required that the second opinion be by a pain specialist. Someone is coming in, the initial physician has made the diagnosis, and there is a process for that. The initial diagnosis that this person is suffering from intractable pain. And then the statute requires that they be seen by a physician who is a specialist in the part of the body in which the pain is. So there's no requirement that they be sent to a specialist in pain management. There's no requirement that they be sent to anyone who could particularly diagnose chronic pain. And so if it could do some of the things that you've heard already, that would be nice, but there's no requirement that be the kind of physician to whom they are sent. And as Senator Minnis mentioned, there is the delay. The Pain Task Force identified it as a barrier to effective pain management, and I believe you will hear testimony later. There are well-known organizations that do a lot with pain management issues and that review all 50 states to see what are the issues. What are the issues to effective pain management in each state? What are the statutes and what are the barriers to effective pain management? And this statute is identified in those publications as Oregon's highest barrier to effective pain management. And that's the major reason it's here. There's another little piece of the bill that you will see that simply, and I don't think there's any opposition to the other one, simply requires, there are forms that doctors must keep when they're dealing with patients. And this simply says that the Board of Medical Examiners will approve and distribute those forms. So everybody's using the same form. Today, I'm told that there are often difficulties because not everyone's using the same form, or you don't get necessarily the same information on different forms. So that's another little piece. And with that, I'm going to stop, and I'll hang around if there are questions later, but I have a colleague here who's a part of all this as well.
Thank you, Senator Dukes. Chair Morissette, Senators. Gary Hansen, State Representative from House District 44 in North Portland. I think when I became interested and involved in this, and it's is based on the suffering that I watched with my wife through her battle with cancer. The approximately 2 years ago, she was diagnosed with a very aggressive form of cancer and died 7 months after that. There were, of course, very, very difficult times. Her medical care that she received was absolutely wonderful. We had good insurance coverage. She had very compassionate caregivers. I mean, there's just no, I can't criticize that whole system at all, with one glaring exception. Before the cancer diagnosis, it was thought that she had fibrous tumors in her uterus. The woman suffered incredible pain for a period of weeks waiting for the surgery. During the surgery, it was discovered that she had the cancer. Very ineffective pain management, and it was very painful. It was just incredible is the only way I can explain it. But our thinking was, well, life's tough. I mean, sometimes you have to struggle through things. As soon as she was diagnosed with cancer, pain was no longer an issue. Her pain was managed well. It was managed correctly. It was certainly there were some elements of pain that was there, but it was dealt with very effectively. The question to me is, why does one type of a disease have good pain management skills collected with it? What is the problem? Why should an Oregonian with a different diagnosis have to suffer at that level? When the techniques are there, the ways to manage pain are there. This isn't mysteries. We know how to do it. It's just a question of whether there's the will to do it, unless it's cancer or unless it's a terminal situation. That's my interest in this. I was appointed by the former speaker to the Pain Management Commission, and my interest is seeing that every Oregonian receives the appropriate and adequate pain medicine and pain management that they deserve. We have problems with acute pain management, which was the situation with my wife. Intractable pain, which is another situation of people that are going to have long suffering pain issues, and then some end of life pain management issues that we deal with pretty effectively. These three bills that you'll see all help improve that general climate for pain management. I don't know, and what the Pain Management Commission has done is identified some of the relatively simple barriers and simple things that can be done. The requiring, as this is the only area of medical practice that we require a second opinion, you know, that becomes a barrier. It may not always be a barrier. Maybe people in some areas of the state can get a second opinion quickly and easily. In Portland, I had last fall, I had a minor nerve problem in my foot. It took me 7 weeks to get in to see a neurologist after being referred by my general practitioner doctor. So two weeks would be kind of, Senator Minutes, 2 weeks would be kind of fast-tracking it to get in to see a specialist. I don't understand this double standard. pain management is important. We need to deal with it. These three bills dealing with scope of practice, this one with the second opinion requirement, and the third one is...
I'm sorry?
Okay. We got the order.
Did you get the psychologist?
Yeah, the psychologist, scope of practice.
Putting effective pain management, a multidisciplinary pain management in the governing bodies, boards.
Okay. And then a general statement on the governing bodies of a lot of the different medical practices, because pain crosses a lot of the jurisdictional lines. Anyway, what I'd like your consideration for these bills. I appreciate you hearing from us. There's a lot of things that we can't do for the people this session. One of the things, though, that we can do, if we want to see quality of life in Oregon improved for Oregonians, is we can deal with the pain management issues, lower the barriers, so that the people that are suffering with pain on a long-term, daily basis can get the relief they need. Short-term, can get the relief they need to promote their healing and promote getting back with their lives. And then I think right now we're doing a pretty good job with the end-of-life issues. But the bottom line is no Oregonian should have to suffer needless pain when we have the techniques and we have the abilities to solve those problems. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Walker.
I was going to say, if I could, Mr. Chair, at a time when we know that a lot of Oregonians are uninsured, they're darn lucky sometimes that they get to the first doctor. I don't know how they're going to get to the second one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen, when your wife, Sandy, right?
Yes.
When she was ill, waiting surgery and didn't know what her diagnosis was, you said she was in pretty intense pain. Had she asked her physician for pain medication?
Yeah, she asked the physician for pain medication. She was given Tylenol 3 and Vicodin at the prescribed kind of minimum dosages at specific, you know, four hour intervals. And this was over a period of about 3 weeks that the pain was dramatically intensifying. At that point, I mean, if... And there's question. Another element of this certainly is education. I mean, if I'm ever in a situation where I'm the caregiver or I'm close to someone that's suffering that type of pain, I will make it known in much stronger terms to the doctor of what's needed. There's a point of some of us try to be as stoic as we can because we don't know what the options are that are out there. So, pain medication was given to her, not in adequate amounts and not possibly the most effective drugs to control the pain.
If I might continue, did she, when that was not effective, did she ask for a stronger pain medication and was denied?
She was told the situation that she's in can be quite painful.
Pardon?
And that was the response?
Yeah.
Well, that's not a very good response. I would have probably said something in response to the doctor that he wouldn't lie. Could you sort of... Unfortunately, I missed the testimony prior to you, two good colleagues coming up. I was on a conference call, but... Could you tell me why doctors are afraid to go beyond? I think it's probably a federal law and they're afraid, but just why don't you tell me, enlighten me a little bit. Why are they afraid reluctant?
Yeah. One, we have a great, doctors are audited. Doctors and pharmacists are audited with their prescriptions. They have to follow every rule very minutely. If a complaint's filed against them and their patient files are pulled, and they don't have perfect sets of records, there's a potential for discipline. Now, if in any other specialty, if you're a cardiologist and you haven't prescribed aspirin to a patient after they've had a heart attack, which is a very, very effective protocol that should be followed for virtually every heart patient. If you don't make a note on the chart that you haven't prescribed aspirin, there's no ramifications to that. But on the other hand, if you haven't documented every reason why you prescribed a stronger drug than Vicodin, then there would be a potential for discipline. I think there's also some misconceptions in the medical field in terms of addiction potentials for pain patients. But a woman 53 years old that has never had any history of drug abuse, that has never had any problems of addiction, it's a pretty stretch, pretty strong stretch to think that those painkillers would cause an addiction.
I just find it interesting that there's such a requirement, a reporting requirement, yet a doctor can indiscriminately prescribe antibiotics and they're being way overused in this country.
Again, it's the double standard in terms of pain management. We've got these barriers. The higher standard for record keeping, the standard that you'd have to refer a doctor, now not for acute pain but for intractable pain, that you'd have to involve another doctor to confirm your opinion, mm-hmm. even if that doctor's not a specialist in pain management mm-hmm. issues. All of these things lead to a climate where Oregonians aren't mm-hmm. adequately dealt with.
Thank you very much. I appreciate both of you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, you've touched upon another issue that makes the second opinion more difficult, and that's that, and you may hear some testimony about it later, I'm not sure, but many physicians in Oregon are very nervous about prescribing narcotic drugs. And I'm not going to say that they shouldn't be nervous about it, but it appears that sometimes that translates into a real hesitation to prescribe them, and sometimes narcotics are the only thing that are going to deal with chronic pain. And in fact, there was a woman that I met recently who moved to Oregon. She came from Stanford University with her plan. She had multiple pain issues with her plan, and she had been surviving fine on it for some time. And she moved to a part of Oregon, and she went to a physician that she understood knew pain management, and he declined to help her. She went through five of them in that area, five of them, who all refused to treat her. Finally, she found someone in a neighboring community who was willing to do it. So when you're asking that someone go for a second opinion and then to verify that they are in tractable pain and should be treated with narcotics, that can be problematic as well.
That raised another question, Mr. Chair, if I could ask quickly. On narcotics, they need a second opinion, but could that same physician prescribe medical marijuana, and does that require a second opinion?
Not to my knowledge. You don't have to be in intractable pain in order to get medical marijuana. The issue is not the drug. The issue is, in the statute, is that they have been determined by a physician to be
in intractable pain.
And that's what causes the second opinion prior to treatment.
Okay. Thank you.
One final comment, Mr. Chair, and this is probably the only time during this day that someone will say that's really a great tie.
Thank you. Yes. Senator Fisher.
We just had some testimony from the Board of Medical Examiners that they create waivers for this type of situation. Does that not basically help to handle it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, with the physicians that I have heard from and spoken with about this, if they are aware that a waiver is available, and not all of them are, it may help. But the truth is that in many rural communities, you're going to have to get a waiver every time, or virtually every time, because simply the second opinion isn't available without sending the patient some long distance. So it seems to be a hit and miss thing. The waivers are not always granted.
All right, Mr. Chair. I have some question about the order the bills were doing in here, because in looking the bills over, we should have done them the other way around, because the one they billed on it, we're taking the last one in the notch first. And I don't know whose idea that was or why, or if somebody was here that couldn't be here later on to testify or what. But if we would have taken the bills in their order as they were originally established here in the record, we would have billed upon it and been able to examine each one in the light of the building blocks as they were established. The first bill, Senate Bill 434, if it's accepted, it does away with the problem of having doctors know about waivers and all this kind of thing, because it specifically directs all of the board of the professions to get that stuff out and make it known to their members and to their profession. So we would not have that. And secondly, in a rural area, I'm here to tell you that it's very unlikely that they're going to have to be calling five times a day for a waiver. They're going to be fairly seldom and fairly far apart, so it's not going to be something that's just a constant run to the telephone type thing. So I would think that we could handle this in a little bit of a different way without maybe destroying the need to be pretty careful about what we are doing, things where we do have the opportunity of going one step further.
Morissette, Senator Fisher, I just wanted to say that I wish the other bill did what you think it will do. It puts it into the board's missions there, whatever board's statutes, but doesn't require that they do anything. It encourages them to get multidisciplinary, and I would say that heavy on the multidisciplinary pain management for that particular bill.
The reason I reversed the bills is that I asked.
Fine. There's no sense in keeping a lot of people who wanted to testify.
That's right. That was the reason. Right. Okay. Thank you very much. Kathy Hahn and Alan Chino, would you please come forward? And then I will call Hank Holmes later, and Ed Johnson will come up together after we're through with this testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Morissette. I am Kathy Hahn. I am a doctor of pharmacy. I practice pharmacy at Bi-Mart in Springfield.
Oh.
Yeah. I'm glad to be here. And senators. I am the chair of the Pain Commission. My role there is as a patient advocate. We have worked for the last year looking at barriers and trying to figure out why pain management is not happening the way it needs to happen in Oregon. And it is a very real problem. We have gone in two different directions. We're very concerned about education of physicians and other allied health professionals. And we have the bill that was passed, 885, charges us to come up with a curriculum for all these different professionals, and we will have a required continuing education for these people that will start in 2005. So we have a part of that that's being worked on. The other part that those of us that are here right now are very interested in is discovering barriers and trying to figure out how we can free them up. One of my roles as chair is to do lots of background research in other states, trying to figure out what their pain policies are, what their intractable pain laws are, what's going on out there. We have a wonderful example in the Wisconsin Pain and Policy Studies Group. I don't know if you've ever heard of them, but they are the ones that come out with all of the information on what's happening. They're the ones that Senator Joan Dukes discussed, that they do a yearly analysis on every state and where we're at with our pain policies. And they're the ones that graded us on what was going wrong here. In looking at their suggestions, our Intractable Pain Act is way too narrow. It has, we're trying to make the Intractable Pain Act, when it was first put out, I believe in 95, it was supposed to encourage doctors to feel comfortable treating pain, intractable pain, with narcotics. It was supposed to give them the freedom to prescribe the way they thought they needed to without sanctions from the board. Sometime later, another part was brought in by the Board of Medical Examiners that put in this little part of having a specialist in that part of the body where the pain originates. And, you know, unbeknownst to a lot of people, that was just brought in by the BME, and it changed somewhat the whole complexion of the bill, of the Intractable Pain Act. What we are seeing right now, and we were kind of looking at a lot of the docs in the state that have been sanctioned or investigated, and we look at what has gone on with them, and we see what's happening with this Intractable Pain Act as almost becoming a tool for the BME to sanction or kind of put their pressure on docs, which has to some extent put a pall on physician ordering of narcotics in the state. It is no secret that there are many, many physicians out there that if you are an intractable pain patient, you go in asking for treatment, they will say, let's see, treating you or my license, which one do I want? And that is going on all over. So this is just one step that the commission is making. A very important step. We do not do this lightly. We do not feel that this is endangering citizens of Oregon. On the contrary, we think that this is encouraging comfort. And I guess I'll end with that. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Minnis.
Ms. Hahn, you have a PhD in pharmacology.
PharmD.
PharmD.
Yes.
What is that?
PharmD is a doctor of pharmacy.
All right. So... I'm clearly familiar with the subjects you practice in the area.
I practice, I specialize in chronic pain in a community setting, which is almost unheard of.
Tell me a little bit about how a pharmacy might track the prescription writing habits of physicians.
Well, we have our computer files. Mostly what I do when I'm dealing in chronic pain patients, I'm a member of a Pain Society of Oregon. We have a lot of physicians that I interact with, and we have kind of a loose association where they will send their patients to me, and I have files on all of these patients. We keep way closer track of them than anyone else.
In your practice, and if you can't answer the question, that's fine. I mean, would you have a reason to believe the particular practitioner may be writing more script than they and would otherwise be reasonable or would be inconsistent with what? Nor would that send up a red flag, or would you ever turn a physician and say, I think there might be a problem here, or talk to colleagues about a particular practitioner?
I have been trained in chronic pain management. And in chronic pain management, you learn that for some patients, there is no ceiling dose. There is no quantity of medication that brings a red flag. You learn to know that patient, to have dialogue with the physician, and you never make judgments according to...
So, Ms. Chairman, in fact, you're dealing with a very specialized area.
Yes.
You're not working in...
I'm dealing in chronic intractable pain.
Okay. I think maybe you're not the right person to ask the question to.
So maybe we also have... I also run a pharmacy in Springfield. It's the busiest Bi-Mart in the chain. Mm-hmm. And we fill an average of 3,000 prescriptions a week.
Right.
And in that, we have lots of... Vicodin and Tylenol with codeine prescriptions that are forged, that are called in. We have the other side of pharmacy where we're constantly watching for things that, you know, being duped, bogus prescriptions coming in. And that happens all the time. but that is very clearly different than my practice in chronic pain management.
And Mr. Chairman, that's I guess that's the point I'm trying to get to, is that if you practice in a particular area in a pharmacy, if you have some druggie that shows up at your counter who's doing what they do, it raises red flags, I would assume.
Yes.
Perhaps you wouldn't fill the prescription, or maybe you would call.
Yes.
Try to verify with the physician.
Yes.
In fact, they have seen this.
Yes.
That's what I'm trying to get to.
Yes. The two are very different. The two are very different.
And that's the point I'm trying to establish.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
That's it. They're just two different things. Okay.
Yes.
All right.
What is it about yes that you don't understand?
I'm Republican.
Oh! Senator Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Minnis is getting to be a harder and harder act to follow. My question is so simple and so straightforward, I'm almost ashamed of it. How many states require this double opinion, this second opinion?
Let's see, I'm supposed to do this right. I'm supposed to say, Mr. Chair and Senator Shields. Is it right?
Catches on fast.
In looking at all the states, I can't give you an exact number. I probably saw one or two that were as severe. I'm using as restricting as ours.
Okay.
Well,
and that follow up?
Yes.
That would imply that about 45 or more states are less restrictive than Oregon with regard to pain management.
Yes.
That's back up the answer.
It went over my head.
Yeah. Well, the two of us are trying to decide whether it's more restrictive or less restrictive.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. He already explained it. He's Republican.
Oh, ouch.
But she's Democrat, so whatever votes are heads.
Senator Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the possibility that I'll reveal my party here, I'm going to ask you a question. In my dealings and having been on the pain management committee and dealt with some of these issues through the session and as chair of the Health and Human Services Committee, I understand a little bit about both sides of the coin, about the feelings of doctors, and if those of you that were on the pain management committee will remember, that was one of my specific things that I stated there, that I felt a reluctance by physicians to put themselves in harm's way, and we went over that pretty carefully in the pain management. However, I have an entirely different story to tell than what you're telling. In my district, doctors have been hammered for not taking proper care of pain, not the other way around.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, you're talking about one physician who has been sanctioned, I think, twice. Once and then maybe
not for the same thing.
Not for the different things.
But
and
definitely the first time for the pain.
Right.
I don't know of anyone that's been sanctioned for overdosing. So I've got one against none. I also read very carefully the actions taken by the Board of Medical Examiners. I don't recall, other than possibly physicians dipping into their own stores or that kind of thing, or doing prescriptions for themselves or something like that, many situations that I can think of that lead me to believe that there's been too many sanctions against people that are overdosing and for pain management.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, we have many doctors right now that are in the middle of maybe sanctioning is not a good word. What happens when there's a complaint to the BME? The doctor appears before the BME and charts are requested, the charts are looked through. then the BME has to decide what they're going to do. Now, many times what happens is that the doctor is requested to go to a continuing education program, and lots of times a specialist, it will be recommended that at the doctor's expense, a specialist come in and look at their charts for some part of a year or a whole year. Sometimes the doctors put on restriction on what they can write. I know many instances. I think there's a website that you can look up that lists the doctors. That information can be, well, I'm sure the BME can get that information to you. We had one meeting of the commission where we had three physicians come in and talk about their experiences.
Mr. Chair, may I make a short statement? Or
introduce yourself.
Yes, I'm Dr. Alan Chino. I'm a clinical health psychologist. I'm the president of the American Academy of Clinical Health Psychology, which is a group of psychologists who are board certified and specialize in treating medical conditions with behavioral and psychological methods. I'm also on the Pain Management Commission. I'm also co-author of a book entitled Validate Your Pain, Exposing the Chronic Pain Cover-Up. I co-authored that with a physician colleague who's an expert in chronic pain management. The premise of our book is essentially that there are a lot of problems in the area of pain management as practiced in this country. The patient is at a severe disadvantage on many occasions. I'm not saying that patients never get treated well. Certainly there are instances in which they do. But in my experience as a behavioral pain specialist, and I've created, developed, directed two multidisciplinary hospital-based pain programs, and then directed one here in Oregon until recently. So I have quite a bit of experience working with real-life human beings who have gone through the whole spectrum of chronic pain experiences. And I can tell you very honestly that we have worked hard in our pain specialty programs to help people find ways to deal with pain with the minimum amount of medication that they're able to function on, but also to function as independently as possible. But they need follow-up care from a physician after they're discharged from our specialty program. We have a heck of a time finding physicians who are willing to treat chronic pain patients, especially those who require ongoing opioid medication therapy. And the feedback consistently seems to be that the physicians mentioned, it's easier not to treat chronic pain patients because I just don't want to deal with the possibility of my practice being looked at by the BME. If you can imagine getting a phone call or a letter indicating that your practice is being looked at, that it's going to be inspected, inevitably you're going to have to take some time off of work. It's a pretty traumatic sort of event. My co-author colleague, who again is a specialist in chronic pain management, went through this in Nevada. She was not sanctioned. The situation that came up was resolved very easily. But I can tell you, she went through a lot of emotional trauma, missed some time at work. It's a big deal. So from what I have heard from physicians consistently is that it is simply much easier to make it a policy in your practice not to treat chronic pain patients. So in my experience, helping people in chronic pain learn pain management skills, getting on the proper medication regimens, and then sending them back home, sending them back to be treated on an ongoing basis as an intractable pain patient, it is extremely difficult to find physicians who are willing to carry on with the regimen that was so carefully crafted.
Okay. Thank you. Questions?
Yeah.
I have a question. Yes. Senator Fisher.
For the way it has been in the past, talks about a knowledge specialist in treatment of the body area, system, or organ perceived as a source of the intractable pain. Is that the possibility of changing that so it's not so limiting?
Are you implying that we still maintain a second opinion requirement But just change the nature or the specialty of the physician?
Change it to perhaps a specialist that was involved with intractable pain or that kind of thing.
Senators, my problem with that really is a very basic one. Dealing with real-life human beings, it takes time to find one physician willing to see these patients. To find two physicians is a much more daunting task. And quite honestly, when we're dealing with people who are in chronic pain every day and every night without sleep, without medication, is a pretty tough scenario for them. Certainly, I think we need to validate and recognize the fact that there is addiction out there, but I agree with my colleagues that addiction is a totally separate issue, and I believe it's an overblown issue. There's a phenomenon called pseudo-addiction in the area of chronic pain management, in which a patient will doctor shop. You've probably heard that term. They'll go to one doctor and another doctor to get a prescription for pain medication. And or they will go to a doctor and then come back and ask for, say they ran out early, they need an early refill, they run out of medications. It looks exactly like addiction behavior, when in fact what's happening is the patient's pain is being undertreated. They're not getting enough medication. In our specialty multidisciplinary programs, we would test that hypothesis by providing carefully the patient with increasing amounts of medication along with other therapies, until we get the pain under control. Once that happens, the addiction-like behavior disappears immediately. And if it doesn't disappear, then we know we've probably got an addiction problem at hand. The problem is, I honestly believe, and we cover this in our book, we kind of do a behavioral analysis of the practice of medicine in this regard. The problem is that many, if not most, physicians never test the hypothesis. They see the addiction-like behavior, and then they conclude that we've got an addict on our hands. Therefore, there's a culture that's been built up over the years in healthcare in which it is just recognized or thought to exist that there are a lot of addicts in the area of chronic pain. Chronic pain patients are, quote, difficult. They have a tendency to be addicted. And this stems from not a problem with the patient, but I think a problem in our healthcare environment and our willingness to test hypotheses. Time and again, when we've provided patients with proper medication levels, we have seen addiction behavior drop out. And we've been able to conclude this is not an addict. This is a patient whose pain was inadequately treated. But if you never test the hypothesis, you will never see the true reality of pseudo-addiction.
Yes. Are you saying an addict never gets enough then?
I think that's one of the characteristics. I'm not an addiction specialist myself, but that's one of the hallmarks, I understand, of addiction, is that the levels of the drug keeps going up and up and up. Typically, that's not seen in pain management when they get a proper amount.
Senator Domenech?
You're going to be around for a little bit, right?
Yes.
Okay. I'm toying with this stuff in my mind. Because it seems to me, I have to draw on my own experience. As a police officer years ago, I committed someone who was sawing their fingers off with a serrated knife. Who got themselves intoxicated enough to do their own surgery. And I remember the situation even at this day. I could probably give you the address. But their hands looked a lot like this. And and they're sawing them off. Now, I didn't recognize that as a young policeman, and I felt this person needed to have some psychiatric or some intervention. And it wasn't until I ended up with arthritis and it started advancing very rapidly and came to the legislature and started dealing with some of these issues that I began to understand what would drive a person to the point where they would take a serrated knife, liquor themselves up, and try to saw their fingers off. This woman was not trying to commit suicide. She was trying to get rid of the joints that were enraged in pain and agony. Mm-hmm. So it kind of begs the question for me, if we have people who don't have health insurance or can't get access to health insurance or can't get physicians who are afraid to deal with the pain issue, because they're never going to test the hypothesis if they're afraid that they can't prescribe the medicine. So it's kind of a moot point. And so I'm saying all this to say I'm really not sure where we're going with this. It seems to me that we trust physicians to do surgery. We trust them to cut us open with knives and do their thing and sew us back together and manage our post-operative care and so on and so forth. It just seems to me that this issue is being made much larger than it should be on the front end, because being a police detective and an investigator and someone who's been involved in actually investigating physicians for different things, in fact, the unit I work in have arrested physicians for sexual misconduct and this kind of thing, that we ought to focus on what the real problem is, and that would be a physician who is engaged in criminal conduct, mm-hmm. as opposed to somebody who's really trying to mm-hmm. deal with the issues relevant to their patient care. So, but there are other complex issues, because I know that the DEA does get involved in some of these kind of oversights and reviews. So, and the BME, I'm going to have the BME hopefully come up and mm-hmm. ask them a few more questions. Okay. That's my little dissertation on how I feel. I don't know if I'm tracking on the issue or not, but it seems to me that we've got a real disconnect here somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Senator, that makes a lot of sense to me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have two more witnesses. Dr. Holmes, would you come up? And Ed Johnson, would you come up, please? Yes. Ed, you want to go ahead? Do you have testimony to hand out?
No, I don't have copies of all my medical reports, but this is my medical file proving that I'm about ready to testify, and I will sign releases for every agency involved.
Dr. Holmes, do you want to go ahead then?
Yes, Senator Morissette and other senators. I'm a family physician and I've lived in Oregon for 25 years. I actually have an interesting history in that I came here during a time when the economy wasn't very good and took a job doing chronic pain management when pain centers were first in there birthing. And after that, I've been the medical director for four different pain centers over time. I'm now doing occupational medicine and family medicine in Albany with a sidelight of doing pain consultations for primary care doctors that have problem patients and need some help with them. And my background, right now I am not on the pain commission, but I've been very actively involved as somewhat of an ad hoc member. And part of the reason, I think, is I was burnt out as a pioneer in this chronic pain field, knowing the extra lengths that you really have to go to do a good job in what I consider to be an adversarial environment. There's a tremendous stigma that goes with the experience of chronic pain, and it's not just in Oregon, it's across the country. And it has been shifting, and it's shifting rapidly now. So that when I first came to Oregon, the Board of Medical Examiners preached, and Joel Sears, who was a neurosurgeon, very respected, went around on a circuit and preached that anyone that prescribed opiate medication to anyone with chronic pain, non-malignant pain, was essentially committing malpractice. And so at that time, pain centers also were the place that you sent these people of last resort, people that the family physician really believed in them, believed they were suffering, knew that they weren't getting treatment. And so we came, and I really prized that time because we used everything we possibly could. We used psychologists, biofeedback, physical therapy, every kind of non-opiate medication, hypnosis, you know, whatever we exercise in order to help that person to gain some control over their pain. So I know what it's like to practice without opiates, and I've been part of this movement that opened my eyes to say, you know, it works a whole lot better if we can use opiates openly as part of an overall treatment approach. Now, getting back to the Pain Commission, our real charge was in education, that we would, you know, put out some good state-of-the-art education to doctors here, so hopefully we do a better job. But as we sat down to talk about it, we kept coming back to, it doesn't matter how good the education is. The education is already out there. You know, if doctors are afraid to just incorporate pain management as a normal part of their daily practice. Now, the board may feel differently, and there have been a number of attempts to change that climate. It is changing, but the run-of-the-mill family physician is still afraid that by appropriately prescribing, they're putting their license in jeopardy, and it's just not worth it. And so we may have somewhat of a disconnect about what the board intends and what's actually happening. Now, go back to the Intractable Pain Act. That came out as a cry from the people of Oregon that our needs are being are not being heard or addressed. The legislature took that on, passed what was then a very progressive bill that says, look, we want you guys to step in, doctors, and treat this pain, and we want you to know that your license isn't on the line if you do that. You know, please help us and become part of the solution. And that was innovative at the time. Unfortunately, in 1999, and this issued out of the board, it came back and asked for additional things, that you get a second opinion and that it has to be X, Y, and Z. And the very language that was meant to say to doctors, if you do X, Y, and Z, your license will not be on the line, has been construed to be, if you don't do X, Y, and Z, you're in big trouble. And not only that, you better do it, you know, according to somewhat vague guidelines. And so our focus, getting back to the pain commission, is we really felt we need to do something to invite physicians again, or all of our educational efforts weren't going to be worth a darn. Now, we get to this issue of abuse and dependency and people dying of drugs, drug overdoses, and all of this. And I want to tell you that nationally, and study after study after study tells you that addiction has zero to do with appropriate prescribing for chronic pain. You can look at it from the standpoint of 100 people walking through the door getting large doses of opiates to treat their pain, and only 0.5% will develop an addictive problem. The problem that prescribing opiates does not create addiction. Now, if 100 people walk through your door asking for medication, how many of them will be addicts? I don't know the answer to that, but yes, there are people who are already addicted who will use whatever avenue of obtaining medications that they can. We're stuck, however, with a philosophy that's really outdated, where we have a board that was put in place primarily to punitively approach this problem, to scare people out of, you know, dabbling on this in this pain treatment, and it is a mixture of the role of the board, which is legitimately to prevent abuse and diversion and addiction on the one hand, but what we're failing to do is to really invite people and say, we have a crisis in pain treatment in Oregon. Unless you guys step up and do something, it's not going to happen. Now, we are not going to solve the problem with more pain specialists. We're not going to solve it with more pain centers. Chronic pain is as common as high blood pressure or diabetes, you know, all of these things that doctors see coming across, you know, through their practice day in and day out. And to set up a standard that's well above things that are just as dangerous or frightening, from cancer to congestive heart failure, to set up a standard with regard to pain treatment, which is above all of those, just doesn't make sense. It makes a major obstacle to the receipt of treatment, not only in the timeliness, because you want to treat pain from the get-go. The person comes through the door, they've got intractable pain, as the senator said, you want to start treating that even as you go about your diagnostic testings and find out, you know, what is the diagnosis? Is it treatable? Is it preventable? And you don't want something where a doctor's saying, well, I better not do this because unless I've, you know, gone through this whole list of informed consent. The other things about that second person seeing the person doesn't work for people in nursing homes, doesn't work in rural areas, doesn't work for uninsured people, delays treatment, and it's already built into, and the board has the ability to take action on people that do inappropriate practice, negligent practice. If you didn't do the right test for a cardiac patient, if you misdiagnosed a diabetic, if you did this or that, they already have the ability to investigate and take action. You don't need those additional powers and apply them directly to pain alone. I passed out something here, which is the Federation of State Medical Boards. This is all of the state boards in the country getting together, because this is an issue in every state, and they made model guidelines in 1998. Now, I would really like it if this state would adopt this and tell the board, we would like you to operate, you know, in line with the philosophy and intention of this organization. Probably, I think it's around 20 states have adopted this in full as their intractable pain guidelines. Others have adopted half or more. We're behind the times. This does not include needing to have anything more than normal and usual medical diligence in the treatment of chronic pain. That, of course, if the diagnosis is unclear, you get a consultation. If things are more severe and not being controlled, you get a second opinion. And you keep doing that, just as we do for all medical conditions. I would actually make the assertion that I think most pain patients have had way too much diagnostic evaluation, way too much surgery, way too much technology without someone very human sitting on the other hand being willing and open and able to prescribe and do whatever's needed to help control the pain. We're spending a lot of healthcare dollars because we're afraid to get in and grapple with the pain. So I would like it, and I noticed that the board is, Board of Medical Examiners here, is supporting that this be updated. If it is updated every few years, it's something that we didn't put it into this proposal. Joan Dudson was a little bit reticent to tell the board how to do their business. But if indeed this is going to be updated and if states across the country have utilized it, put it into their guidelines, it's a way that we can stay up without having to reinvent the wheel, you know, here in Oregon. I do believe, and I really respect the volunteer nature of the Board of Medical Examiners. The physicians are there for 3 years. They can come again for 3 years. They really don't get paid other than maybe some little stipend. They're good physicians. And like all volunteer boards, they're giving their time out of the goodness of their heart. I suspect, and I don't know, let me backtrack to something. I was just reading this Board of Medical Examiners reports. You heard from Kathleen Haley about the board, and in this report it says the BME is cooperating with the commission and working with the commission in order to answer the physician-patient concerns. In reality, Dr. Parsley came once to our meeting. The board has been invited for every meeting. They've not attended any of the representatives. It's been more as if what the work we were doing might be somewhat of a threat. I don't know why it's a threat, because I really believe that the board and our commission should be working together on this, but we're not. I believe that the legislature has told the board that we want a climate in the state of Oregon which is conducive to good pain management. I don't believe we're getting that action out of the board, and I think the legislature should make that known. From the standpoint of saying, do whatever you need to separate out the issue of dependence and abuse and all of this from the issue of the everyday prescribing that every physician needs to do. Don't treat someone who didn't cross the dot the I or cross the T or get the second opinion in the same category as somebody that's selling prescriptions. Yes, I'm getting emotional, but you know, part of the reason is that this was the same issue that was physicians came to me 15 or 20 years about. Would you review my charts, Dr. Holmes? I didn't think I did anything wrong. This patient was suffering, and I've done this, and now the board is bringing me up here. Now I have to have an attorney, or I have one of the very few addictionologists in the state that actually had an open mind that some people had both addicted disease and pain, and you managed it, who was brought before the board. And that was... I've just seen too many good people taken through the wrong process, and I believe that process should be non-punitive for most physicians, so that instead of, because what happens is once you've gone through that, your malpractice may go up, you may be taken off certain panels of physicians, so that a big part of your practice is, you know, jeopardized. It is a risk for physicians to actually do pain management well, and because of that, fewer do it, and that means that more of those patients go to fewer doctors who are then overwhelmed, you know, with the need and block their doors. If these changes are part of, I think, baby steps that we need, the commission would like to move on to education, we'd like to move on to other disciplines, we'd like to move on to insurance barriers and other stigmas. But this is where we need to start.
Senator Fisher?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking through this and I didn't see Dr. Philip Levesque's name on this.
Who?
Dr. Philip Levesque. Doctor, is there any change in the perception of the board in the last, say, 3 or 4 or 5 years since we dealt with our big pain task force?
I think that I was really encouraged because I felt there was a shift when Dr. Hicks was the medical director and he talked to medical groups. And I really thought that there was a shift that was inviting doctors to begin to prescribe. It's interesting, though, that Dr. Hicks was one of the main people who came back and put the second opinion requirement, you know, in. And I also am very perplexed at why the board isn't sitting with us and struggling with the question themselves of how can we get more doctors to more effectively engage? Or is the way we're approaching these cases detrimental? Could we do it a different way? I think there needs to be some introspection at the board level. And let me just say that a lot of states have had to do that, and the University of Wisconsin has a team that has gone out and actually worked with boards in a number of states to get them up to date, get them philosophically up to date. And there's funds actually available in this state to do that at no cost to have a group like that come in and meet with our board. My personal opinion is that I believe that doctors need to take over the medical process at the Board of Medical Examiners, and that somehow there needs to be a split made between how do you police and penalize people with illegal practices and the run-of-the-mill types of complaints or prescribing that needs to happen.
Mr. Chair Fallon?
Yes.
If we were to go back, I'm surmising you know about 434, 435, and 436. If we were to go back in 434 and not just put the word encourage, but make it mandatory that the boards will go out and do this education, where does that put the issue? And I'm surmising when you say there's money available that's not being utilized for the process of educational means by the boards, that you're talking about stuff like grants from the Robert Wood Foundation.
It's grants, yes. Yeah. Now, this, Senator Fisher, this to me is really a huge issue that we can't legislate this changing terrain that's going to be going on for the next decade or so. It amounts to how you think about pain and how your family did and your doctor and, you know. And also, even the things that are paid for, I don't know if you know, but insurance companies are able to single out chronic pain conditions and say, we won't pay for this, we won't pay for this, we won't pay for this, in a way that's different than they would with a cardiac condition or a diabetic condition. So we have barriers that are only going to change over time. I like this in the way as it says, we encourage you, we expect you're going to do your best, you know, job to do it. But I would hope that the intractable pain bill gets revisited in a couple of years where we can do something specific legislatively, because there's only so much you can do. And this is one of those things, is to remove barriers. A simple thing, change some language, change some requirements, remove some barriers. But you're going to have to rely on the people on each of these boards. And that's why I tread in kind of gently in my criticism of the board, is we need to be able to rely on them. But I think there needs to be a change of spirit.
Mr. Chair. At the risk of totally showing the ignorance that I have about some of the actual professional aspects of this, having dealt with it now for this is a fourth session as chair of the Health and Human Resources Committee, and having been on the task force and having worked very diligently to try to keep safety
measures in effect so that properly trained people are properly doing things. And so forth. You're saying I can't legislate on the one hand, but you're asking me to legislate on the other hand to change them things. Why can't we step up a little over here and say, all right, we're going to do just a little more than encourage, at the same time that maybe we're going to go back and revisit this thing that you're saying put a roadblock in there back in, was it 99 or 2000? Yeah, I believe it was 99. So it's not working out the way we maybe hoped it should.
You're right.
So we back this up a little bit, but we strengthen the other a little bit. Because, again, as I mentioned, I spoke very strongly out in support of the doctors and their fear, having been a person that's subject to a board myself in a professional sense and having no desire to be called up in front of that board for anything that I would do and not personally trying to do anything that would get me to in front of that board. I understand exactly what you're saying. And so I would like to work with it. However, I would have to say this. I do believe there's been a change for the better in the Board of Medical Examiners and, say, since the 10 years that I've been in the legislative session. Maybe we never arrive at a point where we don't have to continue to look forward and take advantage of new techniques and educational advances and all these kind of things that we have in a fast-growing technology. So, you know, I would very definitely want to work in the areas here to do what we can without maybe, you know, getting too many stones out there and flung back and forth in the process. But I'm asking these questions because I can see where encourage, and I respect Senator Dukes's, I hadn't really looked at it like that. I'd just looked at it and read it briefly as a non-attorney and a non-doctor, and I thought pretty well I would direct it. If I would have been getting those instructions, I would have expected I should have done something about it, not just be encouraged to do something about it. So I would not be necessarily adverse to, especially if we have some opportunity to get some grants and some things like this. I'm for bringing any money we can into the state at this point in time, and I would definitely like to look at it overall, maybe not just zeroing in on one particular facet.
Okay. We're running out of time. Senator Shields, please.
My question is a very quick one. As you showed us this model guidelines for use in controlled substances, just for the record, in there, in number 4 and 5, there was a periodic review and a consultation suggested as part of the model guidelines, but there's nowhere where it speaks of a second opinion, is there? Until you get down to kind of a review where it's
That's entirely true. And the question you asked of earlier is we found only two states that had any requirement for a second opinion. That's so. I think you had asked that before. It is really in the minority. And I guess one piece beyond that is we have done a good job here, but make no mistake, we have really fallen behind the rest of the country in terms of our advocacy for pain in this state, with the exception of course, the Death with Dignity Act. But in terms of your run-of-the-mill treatment of chronic pain, we're running behind.
Thank you. Yes.
Johnson. Thank you. My name is Edward Johnson, now, Lincoln County.
Keep it brief because we're going
to... I understand it. I'm going to try to be as brief as possible. First, I would like to address a concern that Chair Senator Fisher brought up dealing with the waivers dealing by medical examiner boards.
Could you identify yourself?
My name is Edward Johnson from Lincoln County,
okay.
Toledo, Oregon. I could definitely speak as an expert in chronic pain. 1989, I had my head caved in with a pipe. I had herniated disc lodged in my spinal cord. I lived with that until 1998, until I ended up with surgery. In 1997, if it wasn't the grace of Senator Gary George, I would not be alive today. Dealing with the waiver, dealing with medical board examiners, they want me to sign a deal as a chronic pain patient, allowing my home to be invaded by any state, federal, or police agency. It says it right there. I waive the right of my right of my home to any police officer coming into my home to verify if I'm a chronic drug user by signing a chronic pain patient paperwork. Would you sign your home away? Your rights for them to come in? That would be my question. I would not. So that brings me up to a very stern concern. Get back to a little bit of my history here. In 1989, when fought dealing with a work-related injury, going back and forth workman's comp, they finally determined that I had herniated discs in my neck. In 1992, they sent me to the Oregon Pain Clinic. I spent, I believe it was 6 to 8 weeks in the Oregon Pain Clinic going through exercise and physical therapy. Well, I got discs lodged in my spinal cord. Exercise makes it even more painful. So I went through completed chronic pain therapy by the Oregon State Chronic Pain, and I thought that was interesting because I still have a disc lodged in my spinal cord. I know what it's like living in excruciating pain. Believe me, that is not the pain that I wish on anybody. In 1997, when I was still fighting dealing with the disc in my spinal cord, I ended up going through the Department of Human Resources, where they finally sent me to a psychiatrist to determine that the pain in my head was all psychologically in my head, not in my head. 30 days after that determination, that said I had delusions of grandeur because everything was in my head. I wasn't telling the truth and I was not a reality person. I ended up with another MRI. They scheduled me for surgery immediately because it was cutting into my spinal cord. November of 1997, before that termination, I got the letter from DHS, Department Oregon Health, Oregon OMAP. That evening in November, before Thanksgiving, I sat there, as you heard testimony, when you get to a point of pain, you want to end your life. I went through several years of excruciating pain living with that. And then being told by the Board of Medical Examiners going back and forth with other physicians telling me that if we give you medication, we're going to lose our license. We're not going to do that. I physically lived this. I lived with another doctor who stated that I was a drug user by taking chronic pain patient medicine, Vicodin and ibuprofen. So all of a sudden I'm classified as a drug user. Never did it before, but I'm classified as a drug user because I'm taking chronic pain, I'm taking Vicodin. I fought and wrote letters to the medical examiner board because I thought this was outrageous, being falsely accused of something I was not. I was told, oh, write a letter. We can't do nothing about it. It's in your records. You're stuck with it. So, I mean, to me, that's humiliating. So every time my record comes up, all this stuff comes up in my medical file, which I have all medical files dating to the original injury, stating of my injury. It's not in my head. And then November 97, when I decided to get so liquored up, I went to end my life. I had such a muscle spasm, thank the Lord, and that one where I missed my head, the bullet went through my house, through the floor, which, thank God, didn't hit no neighbors. But the 2 days after that, I got the letter stating that my surgery was authorized. So there was a reason. And I guess that's part of the reason why I'm here today to testify. I know what it's like living in chronic pain. I get so frustrated and irritating listening to doctors trying to tell you it's all in your head. When you're physically living through it, trying to justify other medical identities like the Oregon Pain Center sending me through that, instead of taking care of the problem when it was originally there. So for the last 14 years, I ended up going back and forth back to work. Last year, March 4th last year, I ended up with another spinal fusion. I've had two in my neck. Basically, they're telling me I've got no determination much of a future when it comes down to it. When it comes to chronic pain, I'm an expert in that field. So when I listen to these people try to justify their jobs, it angers me. Now, I know I'm not speaking just for myself. I know I'm speaking for a lot of people who would love to be here testifying, but they're out doing their jobs that they can't be here because if they don't do that, they can't pay their bill. But right now, I know what it's like. Because of being a chronic pain patient, I'm on the verge of losing everything. So it really frustrates me when I listen to how people try to justify this. I will never sign a waiver to allow the police department to walk in my house and search my house 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. That's what the medical examiners want me to sign, a release for that. I will not do that. So I'm punished for not doing that. But I will not sign my constitutional rights away. And I hope nobody in their right mind would sign their constitutional rights away. Doctors are definitely terrified. I've been told, and I'm going to restate this, been told by numerous doctors that we won't give you pain medicine because we are afraid of losing our license. Now, I am willing, and I have stated in many Senate sessions the last 4 years, including this one, I will sign the releases. I'll make sure you get medical documents. I can prove everything I say. You know, I don't like going through psychiatry being told I have delusions of grandeur when I'm living a physical chronic pain patient. I'm still living with it today. And when people sit there and try to justify it and try to say because I take two Vicodin a day, I'm a drug addict. I take that to level off the pain, try to make it equal. I've been working with my physician to make sure that I'm on some level where I'm not enduring in extreme pain. You know, I've got two other discs that are herniated in my neck. They go with neck surgery, putting screws in and out of my neck. I don't know what's going to happen. Neither do they. They've done it twice. There are times, you know, when you're screwing in a bone, it doesn't. It's a dangerous procedure. So I'm testimony of living proof of how part of the system goes. I will sign anything and release and make sure that they're on your desks, and I will swing by your offices and make sure that you have them. I am not afraid for my life to be on an exposure. It's been there for the last over a decade. I'm not afraid of it. Ever since I became injured, I have never been afraid of this thing because I get tired of listening to the cover-ups, in my opinion. It's been so frustrating going through therapies, being told one thing that is not a reality. I know what I'm living with. Then they try to convince me that I'm a drug addict and try to have me sign papers that I am when I'm not. Other physicians have. So, I mean, what is this, trying to justify each other's job? What's the fairness? You know, it disturbs me because I lived in this. I've been on several sides of the coin, even with law enforcement, and to see this going on for the last 14 years of my life has been stopped. I haven't been able to go out and enjoy life fishing and hunting like I used to. I was very active in sports, but I knew since 1989, as I was told by my doctor, I would have slipped or fell. I would have been dead instantaneously if that this went in my spinal cord or paralyzed. So tell me what it's like to live in that fear.
We actually have a question.
Yeah, yes.
Mr. Johnson.
Chair, Senator Menace. I
appreciate your testimony. Can you tell me what it is you would like to see accomplished through this bill?
Through this bill, I definitely would like to say with people who are like me in that position with these doctors we're talking about with chronic pain patients, as the doctor said that was testifying for medical board examples, you heard from the doctors referred that doctors know best. Well, let the doctors know best. Let them do their job, not the medical board of examiners threatening them by their license or using that as a tool if a doctor doesn't do what they want.
So, Mr. Chairman, again, if I understand what you're saying to me, you're more than willing to submit yourself to the counsel of your physician if in the physician's opinion a particular drug is or is not warranted.
Definitely. I put my life twice into the surgeon who's given me life twice. You better believe I'll trust a physician if I'm still alive today.
All right. Well, I think that's a good point. I think for the committee, your story is pretty extraordinary and sounds to me like you've been through quite a bit. And just so as you know, if you're a drug abuser, so am I.
Well, so you understand. Because even taking aspirin is considered being a drug addict.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony.
Yeah. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kathleen, would you please come back? Please come up. We have some questions. I believe Senator Minnis has some questions.
I do. What kind of medications are we talking about that are subject to this provision?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I would rather turn to the physician here for the medical issues, if that's all right.
Works for me.
Okay.
Thank you. Any scheduled medications, schedule 2 or 3 or 4 medications.
Okay. So Vicodin would be one of them?
Definitely.
Oxycontin?
Yes.
Okay.
Morphine?
Dilaudid. Yeah, those kind of things. Okay. Do physicians, does the Board of Medical Examiners require physicians to have continuing medical education?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, no, there is no statutory requirement for that.
Does the American Medical Association require?
No. Usually credentialing by any hospital or clinic will be, one of the questions will be continuing medical education.
So the status in Oregon is there's no required continuing medical education imposed by either statute or the Board of Medical Examiners?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, that's correct.
And is there an historical reason that that's the case?
Not to my knowledge, there is now going to be a requirement for continue. The only requirement will be for pain management, and you all passed that last legislative session. And as soon as we get the curriculum from the Pain Management Commission, we'll write the rules, and people will be taking the courses.
Okay, another question. Yeah. Does the Board of Medical Examiners, do you interface with OHSU or the medical schools with respect to the levels of education and training a physician has with pharmacology or drug interactions, drug technology, any of that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I go up and meet with them, as does our medical director, Dr. Parshley, and I was up there this week, actually, and spoke with the director of education and said that they have put that as a part of their curriculum, pain management, and that they are seeing very positive results. And in fact, when I was there this week, one of the fourth year students came up and said to me that she wanted to go and specialize in pain management, and to boot, she wanted to do it in a rural area, which really made us happy because that's where there's a shortage.
Okay, tell me about the waiver process in the statute.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, in my experience, there has only been one request and it was granted.
But, okay, doesn't that kind of speak of a potential problem?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I don't know what you mean.
Well, if you only have one physician who's actually requested a waiver for a patient, we have a population of about 3.25 million people in the state. I have a keen sense for the obvious. It would seem to me that there might be other situations where a waiver might be requested.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, to my knowledge, there hasn't been. And I don't know whether that's because people are getting the consults or they're not aware of it. But our medical director does go out and speak to anyone that will listen, any medical group, and we go at all hours of the day and night to talk about pain management.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, again, was this waiver requirement put in 1999 as... Is that when it was put into law?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I'm not sure about that. I would need to check.
I see revisions in 1995 and then 1999.
So then it would probably be
99. Okay. So you've only had one actual experience with the...
To my knowledge. I can go back and see, you know, if there's any other record of additional requests.
Okay. All right. What exactly is the problem we're trying to solve?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, you mean with this bill or in general?
This particular law and this construct that we have where the additional consult or the additional examination occurs. I'm not using the right term, I know, but what exactly is the purpose of that?
And I'm going to refer to Dr. Williams on this one.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, this has been a enlightening experience for me. I don't envy your jobs. One of the things I've become aware of as I've been sitting here is that you're trying to make some decisions basically with pretty poor information. As you can tell from my testimony, I'm on one extreme of what's been presented today, and you've had another extreme at the other end been presented today. Unfortunately, it's my belief there's not good science to support either one. If there was good science like we have for heart disease, liver disease, those kind of things, we wouldn't be having this discussion. The problem is that there are not good objective studies, not good objective tests to be able to distinguish between the patient who is having true pain and the patient who has a potential for addiction or is addicted. Now, the concept that was presented of the pseudo-addiction versus addiction is one concept, but it's a concept, and it's a finding that's based on subjective testing, not objective testing. Most addiction specialists who are on my end of the extreme do not put much stock into that concept.
Hang on just one second, Dr. Mm-hmm. What kind of physician are you? What are you practicing?
I'm internal medicine, and I work at a Native American Rehabilitation Association.
So you work,
so
with,
I work with
addicts. Persons.
Right.
So there would be an inherent bias, I would assume, in terms of...
And that's my other point, is that because there's not good science, the presentation that you get is based on beliefs, based on personal experience.
Mr. Chairman, I don't understand. I mean, are you a research scientist and a physician also?
No.
So you're a practitioner, correct?
That's right.
Do you do clinical research in pain management?
No, I do not.
Okay. See, I guess I would challenge you, and I'm a cop,
So I don't know any more than you do, other than I happen to have one of these diseases subject to it. But I would submit there probably is some relatively good research out there. And for every physician that you drag across the front of this diocese here who says they don't believe it, there's probably another group of physicians who say they do believe it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I agree with you completely.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, can I point out that the Federation guidelines that were developed, one of our board members did participate in the development of these guidelines. And at the time that the board has been looking at this issue, we have also had, she's no longer on the board, but a physician from Klamath Falls whose sole practice is devoted to pain management, to the multidisciplinary treatment of people with chronic pain. So it is physicians coming together. 9 of the 11 board members are physicians trying to grapple with this very difficult issue and do their best.
Okay, that's another question. I hate to belabor this, but again, from a physician's perspective, I mean, what is it about a physician's judgment that we're trying to second guess? Are we suggesting that physicians don't have enough training in this area, they're not competent in this area, but they are competent in other practice areas like surgery and things that are invasive practices? I'm trying to get, what is it about this? The only thing I can really figure out is we're really trying to root out the people who might be abusers.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I think that, to me, that is the distinction. Trying to determine... as I think our pain specialist colleagues are trying to determine, who is the patient that is in trouble because of the medicines and who needs the medicines, I don't think you'll have any argument from me about the patient that really needs the medicines. Trying to make that distinction is a nightmare, and that's the nightmare that I think most physicians feel. We may say that we're worried about the board, but the reality is we don't want to hurt people. And we go into primary care because we like people. And so when patients come to us and they look like they're in pain, they act like they're in pain, and there is no lab test, there's no PET scan, there's no CT scan that's going to tell me the amount of pain they're in, then we are going to tend to want to help them. And we'll be manipulated by the ones that are drug abusers, and we'll help the ones that need the medicine. And I wish there were a test. If there were a test, we wouldn't be sitting here having this discussion. You know that. It's a tough, tough problem. And I think what the board's perspective is to take a conservative, safe approach. The difference between for this problem is that it's the primary care doc that's writing the prescription, and it's the primary care doc that's getting the pressure from the patients, whether it's legitimate or not, and that's the problem. So the more support, I view this as a support for the primary care doctor, because I want to know what it is I'm treating so that I can make a good risk-benefit assessment on treating them. I believe there is risk. I disagree with Dr. Holmes. I think there is risk with narcotics. I think there's a reason why they're scheduled by the DEA. I think there's a risk with these medications. And you can find statistics. I can quote statistics from the American Society of Addiction Medicine that says there's a 4-5% lifetime risk for narcotic addiction, higher in doctors because we have greater access. But the good science isn't there. That's the problem. And there's no easy way to do an objective test to try to sort this stuff out. So I believe that we're trying to take a more conservative approach to protect people.
Okay, Senator Shields.
Yeah, a couple things, and Senator Minnis began to touch on this. Did you say you work for NARA?
Right, correct.
And where do you work? At all their clinics, or just a clinic in town, and the residential facility towards St. Helens, or where do you?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, I work. I'm the medical director for the clinic in town and for the residential treatment facility on St. Helens Highway.
Okay. The reason I ask that is I've had a good bit of interaction with NARA. I think they do a wonderful job. But it does seem to me that, yeah, that you're working among people who do have addictions, and you would be kind of really targeted toward, and maybe, I mean, the average physician, wouldn't you agree, would not really ever see as many people that might be inclined to addiction as the people you see in your day in and day out work. Is that not correct? And do you think that might in some ways affect how objective you might be? I don't for instance, I mean, I go to the Mount Tabor Medical Group, not that far from where one of NARA's facilities is. Among the patients of that group, you'd have a much, much less addiction rate than you would among the clientele that you deal with every day.
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, I agree with you completely, and I was trying to acknowledge my bias. If there were good solid science, there wouldn't be this spread of opinion. The problem is that there isn't real good science, and so that my beliefs are going to be shaped by my personal experience, just as the beliefs of the pain experts that you've heard from today are also shaped by their personal experience. Most of these physicians and providers will see people on a periodic basis. They'll see the patient when they're having problems, referred by the primary care physician, and then generally address that problem, and then referred back to the primary care specialists again. So oftentimes their exposure to the addiction end of things is more limited, definitely, than mine. Does that often answers the question? I acknowledge my bias,
I guess that's fair. I have two other questions, and one's for Kathleen. I don't know if it was you or your colleague that referred to this document, and somebody referred to pseudo-addiction. And yet there is a definition in here that's recognized by the Federation of State Medical Boards. Is this document a good one? And if it is, why haven't we just adopted it like 20 other states have?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, yes, there is a definition of pseudo-addiction, and I think it is a good document. We are asking them to update this at this next meeting to include under-prescribing for pain to be also a grounds for discipline. We're one of two states doing this. And Dr. Porter, formerly of our medical board, former chair from the Health Sciences University, participated in these guidelines. Our board still felt that while consultation is not mandated in these guidelines, that it is the best practice. And when we were looking at the statute, and the statute really was a collaborative effort with pain patients, as well as those whose family members had suffered from addiction. I was there when the original bill was put in 1995, and that was the group that came together to do that. And so our board felt that a consultation, as long as we're going to legislate this, because we don't legislate other areas of medical care. We're not legislating about how doctors treat cardiac patients. This is the area that's legislated, and our board felt that consultation was the best medicine.
Thank you. Senator Morissette, the final question or comment I have is maybe for you, but we've heard the claim that there isn't good science, and yet we had at least one author here this afternoon. Maybe there is good science. Mm-hmm. And we're just not aware that there's good science, and so if possible, if there's anybody here that would like to address that question of whether we really do have good science or not, I'd appreciate hearing a response to that.
Before we get to that, did I hear you right that you're going to discipline physicians who underprescribe for pain, possibly? Is that what you...
Mr. Chair, the Oregon Board has done that. We were the first state to do that.
Okay.
We are advocating that be part of the model guidelines.
Okay.
That's right.
Okay.
Because we do see that as a potential problem. There's no question about it.
Okay. So the physicians are put in a situation where if they don't get it just right, they're in trouble.
Mr. Chair, no, that's not the case. In fact, the statute calls that there be a material risk, an informed consent given to the patient before they're prescribed these controlled substances.
Okay.
If the board gets a complaint against a physician because that form isn't in there, or it's not signed, or those types of things, those physicians are not disciplined. They are not disciplined.
Okay.
The cases in which we're talking about discipline are where there's serious... Mm-hmm. mismanagement of the patient. Serious. And we were talking about deaths, and that does happen, unfortunately.
Yeah, Senator Fisher and then Senator Minnis, and then we're going to wrap it up.
Yeah, I think I would hazard a guess that what you're talking about scientific evidence and stuff like that, if I cut my finger and it goes through, you can ascertain how deep it went with a tape measure or whatever else you use. You can see the extent of the damage. You know whether a tendon's been ripped or not. You can't look inside the soul of a person and measure it. And that is where you really come down to this. You can't look into the soul of the doctor that's treating it. You can't look into the soul of the patient that's needing the treatment. There is no way to measure that depth in any kind of a systematic mechanical measurement. You can see the occlusion on a vein or an artery or the other type of things, CAT scans, things like that. You can't CAT scan pain. And so I understand the situation that you're facing in trying to absolutely get concrete scientific established evidence that can be measured in a practical manner. And every single person will relate a little different. I would dare say that almost everybody uses a little different vocabulary as they describe their problem to you. You're not even using the same nomenclature and that kind of thing from one patient to the next. And this is the perplexing thing. And this is why I was asking the questions that I was asking about increasing this from encouraged to making it mandatory, taking out maybe this thing, or making it to where a mental specialist or something like that was looking into it instead of somebody that was familiar with that body part, trying to work within the framework that we have, because, as you may say, we have legislated in this arena. There's no doubt that we have. Well, if we can't solve it with legislation, then we better throw the whole thing out and take the legislation out of it and just let it go and let you guys handle it the best you can. And I don't necessarily believe that that's the case. I think that we can come down to something a little better here. If we've gone a little too restrictive, if we've gone maybe not restrictive enough in another area, I think we can adjust it down to some extent. But I don't know myself, and as I said, I've dealt with this now for some four sessions as chair and involved with the health and human services issues, two sessions prior to that as a member of the committees, and I'm perplexed myself as to how we do it. But I also, and Kathleen was in my office this morning, we discussed this along with John McCulley and for what, half an hour, 45 minutes, about the effect and about the pressures that board can place on their subjects and that kind of thing. And some of these things are very real. And yet, as I stated before, I do believe that we've had considerable change and considerable betterment in the operation of our Board of Medical Examiners in the last 10 years. And I'm glad of that. So I would really like to see where we're dealing with something that's not so exact. If we can, by maybe tipping the scales a little off the one end, raising a little on the other end, handle some of this and try to work with it. Because I came to the conclusion myself in the pain task force that we are dealing with something that's very real to some folks.
Okay, Senator Minnis has a quick question and we're going to wrap it up. Or statement.
You don't want my philosophical
decision. Go ahead and be philosophical.
Yeah, no, I just, you know, I wouldn't have believed the issue of pain and pain management until I ended up with arthritis, and I have psoriatic arthritis that's similar to rheumatoid, blah, blah, blah. I would never have believed the level of pain that I went through until, you know, I got some good counsel with a good rheumatologist and some good medicines. I have a philosophical reason for wanting to support legislation like this and make sure that it's functional for practitioners in the in their practice areas, and that the Board of Medical Examiners or any other group does not have the capacity to intimidate or threaten people vicariously or otherwise in terms of how they practice in this area. Because Oregon is the only state in the nation that allows physician-assisted suicide. And to that extent, my philosophical disagreement with the choice that someone might make relevant to killing themselves under Oregon's Death with Dignity Act, such as it is, to me, in the discussions we had in 1997, was that we wanted to open up the door so physicians could practice in this area so that individuals who did have pain might not make that choice.
And it's a deep philosophical view on my part that we ought to do the very best we can to make sure that folks who do want to live but are faced with intractable pain would have the opportunity to have a decent quality of life and perhaps not make that choice. And Oregon's chosen to allow that option. It's part of our law, and it is what it is. But from a legislative perspective and my view on it, I want to make sure that this law works well. The question I do have for you is the waiver issue. The gentleman, Mr. Johnson, who spoke, said something about constitutional rights being waived with respect to search and seizure issues, and that kind of got my antennas up. Is that true? Do you do that? What happens?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I don't know anything about. We never ask any complainants to sign anything like that.
The patient doesn't have to sign a waiver form allowing law enforcement to
come. Is that the medical marijuana law?
I'm not.
Medical marijuana law may be different.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, I thank you for your testimony. Okay.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
And we'll close the hearing and we'll adjourn for the day. Thank you. Thank you all.